What could be better than that? I don't have to worry about anything. I was excited about VCU, and it grew on me. And in the same way, I'm really excited and I love Greenville. I really do love Greenville. If we could just pick it up and put it right next to the ocean, I'd be set. Then I could still surf a little bit in my life. But you know the thing that about ECU and college in general that was really alarming to me is that at 18 years old, you're supposed to like map out your entire life. And I was just under pressure, like, how am I supposed to know when I'm 18 years old what I want to do in 20 years, in 30 years? I'm supposed to figure this out now? Am I that immature, or is it everybody? I don't know, but I just couldn't stand that. What am I supposed to do? And so as I'm sitting here thinking about what am I going to do with my life, I'm also considering what the possibilities are. There was a guy in my high school, and what he did night after night after night, we were in the punk rock phase. I don't know if punk rock is even alive anymore. But it was when I was there. It was alive, and it was thriving. And he would take his tapes and he would throw them on stage. Every concert, he'd throw them, just throw them. And he would be throwing these tapes so that someone would listen to his music. And you know what? Someone actually did. He moved out to California, someone listened to his music. He got on the radio. After the radio, he got on MTV. And after MTV, he got on TV. You know, Pepsi did all these little concerts. And his band was called Yellow Card.
Oh,
Yellow Card. I went to high school with him. It was so cool. I didn't really talk to him, but I just went to high school with him. They were a year older than me, and Ryan Key was the dude. He made it all happen. He was the heart and soul behind the band. It was cool. We lived in a small little area there in our high school, so it was wonderful. It was a claim to fame. But you know what? If you don't have these kind of aspirations, that you're just going to do something great with your life, maybe there's other things that you really want to do. For me, I just wanted to be able to surf, and I wanted to go out to California. And so this was how I was going to accomplish my dream in college. I was going to do something like go out to California, and I was going to build a house and represent the church. And I was just going to do something great. And to get there, I was going to take all of my friends, and Yuhu was going to sponsor us, and they were going to give us an RV. Yuhu was going to come up to East and say, get on, guys, and we were going to get on to Yuhu. We were going to travel around the world, and we were going to do crazy, stupid stuff. And then they would want to make a commercial about us, and you know what we would also do? We're going to stop at every Hard Rock Cafe in every big city. Why? Just because we were that cool. That's why they would want to do all this. And we were going to get out of California and have a great summer. Well, it turns out all of my friends were very excited, and they were like, yeah, I want to do that. I want to do that. One after another. But it turns out I am the only one that goes out of California, and I don't go in an RV, but I do drink a lot of Yuhu. So that was my dream. I got to go out there and surf. It was a lot of fun. But you know, when we think about our dreams in this land of opportunity, you can be so many different things. You could be a cleaver, if that's what you really desire in your life. You can have your own life. You could be the next Bill Gates, if that's what you really want to do. If you want to just throw yourself into love so violently and all of your energy is wrapped up into your relational equity given to one person, and it's in ecstasy, well, then you could be the next Bella Swan. And if you want to be someone just off the street and make it big, you can be the next Ted Williams.
The toilet.
Remember Ted Williams? You don't remember the guy? There's a homeless man. He's got a sign. He says, "I have a golden voice."
Oh yeah.
Oh, the dude with the golden voice. And now he's the voice of the Cleveland Cavaliers. That is Ted Williams. He's the guy. No. I don't have the golden voice, but he does. It's amazing that when we have these dreams in our life of what we want to become, it all comes down to our choices. It just comes down to what kind of choices we're going to make, and how are we going to pursue these things, and what direction we're going to put ourselves in. And there's a man in the Bible who has an incredible choice that's given to him, and his name is Lot. Now, I'm going to give you a little bit of background here, because Lot, his uncle, is named Abram. And Abram is given a command by God, and it says this: go to a land I will show you. He says, okay. He's also given a promise with it too, and the promise says this: I will make you a great nation, and many people are going to be blessed by you. Now, Abraham gets hooked up with his nephew because Lot's father passes away. He's an orphan. And also, the grandfather passes away too. Abraham's father, his grandfather. So Abram's really the next guy in line. If I mess up the name Abraham and Abram, it's really hard. Imagine your best friend changing their name and then you getting it wrong. Yeah, it's a little hard at times, and so that's what he did. People refer to him as both names still, and so it's a little challenging. But they go, and they're obedient to God, and they get into this land. But at the land, God finally says, this is the plot. This is the spot. It's in Bethel. It's Canaan. That's where they go. And there they make this altar to God. They worship God there. But a famine comes. Famine hits in the land. They've got to leave. And they go to the big city. If you had a famine, then maybe you go to Raleigh. You'd say, well, that's where I need to be. They go to a big city. They go down to Egypt. And when they enter into Egypt, just like I would say to my wife, but maybe not everything, I would say, you look really, really good. He looks super, super hot. And that's what Abram says to his wife. And when we go to that city, these guys are going to be jealous of me, and they're going to want to kill me so that they can get to you. So would you just, for my sake, so that it would go well with me, would you just pretend like you're my sister? She does. It's crazy. She does. So they go there, and of course he's right. All these guys, they tell Pharaoh, she is really good to look at. She is desirable. And Pharaoh grabs her. He takes her up. But all these diseases start coming. It really is not going well with Pharaoh. And he finds out, not in some like scandalous way, like, oh, you obviously are not brother and sister. It doesn't work out like that. But God starts showing them that this is not his sister. This is his wife. He says, why would you do this to me? You fooled me. And because all along he had been promoting Abram. He's like, oh, I really love this girl. You're her brother. I'm going to give you a job. I'm going to give you a lot of money. I'm going to give you livestock. And so Abraham's getting really blessed by this. But when this happens, the stuff hits the fan, you know, and everyone is uproar. Like, why would you do this to us? And they just want to kill him. So what Pharaoh does, because he has a fear of God in him. He's like, I don't know what to do. You know, he's just shaking here. And while he's shaking, he says, I just need you to leave. I'm not going to ask you for anything back. I just need you to leave. And so what he has to take his guards to escort them out of the country so that no one would kill them because there's such an uproar in this. And that's where we pick up. We're picking up here. Our first slide is on Genesis 13. So if you've got a Bible, if you want to turn there, we're going to read a few verses from Genesis 13. So Abraham went up to Egypt, or from Egypt to the Negev, he and his wife and all that belonged to him. And Lot went with him. Abraham was very rich in livestock, in silver, and in gold. He went on his journeys from the Negev as far as Bethel, to the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai, to the place of the altar, which he had made there formerly. And there Abraham called upon the name of the Lord. So he got to Canaan. He's remembering the spot he had been before. He's visiting the place when he had first got to Canaan, and God said, that's the spot. He's there again. He's remembering that time of worshiping God. And it continues. But Lot went with Abram, and he had flocks, he had herds and tents, and the land could not sustain them while they were dwelling together, for their possessions were so great that they were not able to remain together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. Now the Canaanite and the Perizzite were there dwelling in the land too. So Abram said to Lot, please let there be no strife between you and me, nor between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brothers. We're brothers. Is not the whole land before you? Please just separate from me. If you go to the left, then I'll go to the right. And if you go to the right, then I'll go to the left. Lot lifted up his eyes, and he saw the valley of the Jordan. It was well watered everywhere. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. It was like the garden of the Lord. It was the land of Egypt, as you go to Zoar. So Lot chose for himself all the valley of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed eastward. Thus they separated from each other. Abraham settled in camp, while Lot settled in the cities of the valley and moved his tents as far as Sodom. Now the men of Sodom were wickedly, exceeding sinners against the Lord. And the Lord said to Abraham, after Lot had separated from him, now lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward. For all the land which you see, I am giving it to you and your descendants forever. Tonight, with this great choice, we're going to look at it in three ways. We're going to look at the problem of a choice, how the choice can paralyze you, and the faithful choice. We're looking at the problem, the paralyzing, and the faithful choice. What's the problem? Well, the problem here is over water. It's over wells. And this was something that's really common at the time. Abraham does this, his son does this, his grandson does this. There's always a problem with water and pasture because they have livestock. We don't really deal with that, we get other problems. But that's the issue here, and it's really obvious because the herdsmen are the ones that are fighting with each other. It's obviously over water. That's the real problem here. And it's so surprising that they have been together for years. They've gotten rich together. They've been through travesty together. They got kicked out of countries together. They got humiliated together. That's what they've been through. And nothing could separate them. Nothing. Nothing could tear them apart from each other. But you know what the one thing that could drive a wedge in between them was? Their riches. It's the severity of blessing. How blessed they are. That's the problem. That's the thing that could drive them. And you know what? They're not alone here. It's the Canaanites and the Perizzites. So if you're in here, anybody country folk in here? You live out in the country? You got a few? You're the Perizzites. Not Perizzites, but Perizzites. That's who you are. They're the same group of people. If you lived in Canaan, if you lived out on the outskirts, you're called the Perizzites. And so the Perizzites are out there too. And you know, they're looking on and watching this whole thing happen. One of the reasons they're looking on and seeing this feud in between Abram and his nephew Lot is because they don't have TV. And so we are naturally attracted to something. They don't have Oprah. They don't have Dr. Phil. They don't have Jerry Springer. And so this is the next best thing going on. Every night, they're at home and they're saying,
"Hey, did you see what happened over there? Yeah, that was crazy. He almost punched him."
If that's what they're looking at. This is their entertainment. That's all they got. But you know what? There's another interest too. Because whenever they're over there fighting, they could also be saying, this is a great opportunity for us to increase our land. We could go and take a little land from them while they're preoccupied with their family feud. You know, we could go and maybe steal some of their livestock. You say, well, stealing's wrong. They didn't care. They're just going to go do it. There is an opportunity there. So the settlement needs to happen, for one, for Lot and Abram to have peace amongst themselves, their family members. But it also needs to happen so that they are a prime suspect to get plundered. So there's multiple reasons here. And so Abram gives them this choice. But you know what? The choice that Lot makes is just way too shallow. His choice is way too shallow. Have you ever had a friend who started dating someone and you were just like, why would you do that? They are completely the wrong person for you. Why would you ever want to date them? And you're wanting to wring their neck. This is so stupid. And you're just wanting to teach them. Is that my thing? Yeah. I've got them. So that's what this is like when you've got something that's painfully obvious. There's something that's painfully obvious. That it's almost like it was common knowledge here. But you're trying to help your friend, and the Bible's saying the way you feel there, that's what was happening here. That kind of scenario where you feel like, didn't you see what this is and how bad this is? That's what's happening in this situation. So why is that happening here? It's because it's in verse 10. It says, this was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. See, it's trying to express something that has a lot of meaning behind it. Some of the guys and I were out the other night, and we were talking about Compton. And they were like, oh, Compton, it started this easy, he started this, and all this sort of stuff. Because when you say Compton, you know exactly what it means. It means if you're an officer, you never go there because you won't come out alive. If you walk in late at night, you just don't go there. You don't go there. There's a fullness of meaning that comes with so many innuendos, so many subtleties. It's like you're talking about the bad part of town. You don't have to explain anymore. You know exactly what you mean. You're not going to live there. You're not going to move there. You don't go there late at night. There is a meaning that comes behind it, and that's what is being said here. There is something beyond that is common knowledge that we need to get acquainted with. So it was common knowledge that this place was horrible. You would never want to move here. The sexual immorality was horrible. The pride was horrible. It was common knowledge that why would anybody any fool want to move there? Why would you want to do that? But yet Lot, in his decision, he decides to overlook the inhabitants of the land. He's just like, I don't care about the neighborhood I move in, I'm just happy there. Who of us would approach, like, buying our first house, and just say, I don't care about the neighborhood, there's a lot of drugs, there's a lot of crime, there's a lot of rape going on, oh yeah, I'm cool with that. None of us would look at that and say, that's smart. We would look at it and say, that's ridiculous, but yet, that's what he does because there is so much knowledge wrapped up in Sodom and Gomorrah. But he just threw that out and said, but that land looks good. There's a lot of water there. And he's coming from a place where they're having fights over water. So he doesn't even care about the neighborhood he's getting ready to move into. And he says, it just looks good to me. I'm going for it. That is the shallowness of his choice. He just doesn't look deep enough. But there's also a selfish part of his choice, too. It's completely selfish of what he's doing. You know, I'm convinced that there are two kinds of people in the world, and you either fall into one or the other. You are the type of person that you either send out your Christmas list, and you say, this is what I want. Or you're the kind of person that says, you should know what I want. You're one or the other. You just either, you're one or the other. Not one's better than the other, because if you don't get it, you're like, you should have known. And if you do get it, you're like, well, you're maybe like, well, I told you what to get. You know, maybe it's not like it. Either way, you know, we want something. There's something that we're looking. And I think here, Lot was the kind of guy that gave his Christmas list. He's like, this is what I want. I just want to make it easy for you. But what he does when he gets this choice from his uncle, it says he looks up with his eyes. He starts to see what was happening and what is going on. And it makes an allusion here. It said this land that was well-watered, that was well-situated, that was pleasing to his eyes, the allusion is that it was just like the Garden of Eden. It reminded him of the Garden of the Lord. And so what is it drawing in here? It's that. The same feeling that Eve and Adam had towards the fruit. It was desirable for them for food. It was desirable for them for what it could give them. It could give them wisdom. It could give them something that they beyond what they had now. It could fulfill them. And so that's what he was feeling. The same way Adam and Eve felt about this fruit and what it could do for their life. When he looked at that valley, when he looked at that land, that's the way he felt. He felt, this is going to do it for me. So what is he trying to do? He is trying to recreate the garden in his life. He's trying to remake the Garden of Eden so he can walk in. He's just like, this is it. If I choose that land, my ambitions will prosper. My life will prosper. This is going to give me the life I want. You know, that's what he's seeing here. He's seeing a land of possibilities, and he's excited about it. But isn't that truthfully what we are all trying to do? Aren't we all in our own lives trying to do what Lot is doing here, to recreate the garden? Because in the garden, we knew we had value. In the garden, we knew who we were. In the garden, we knew that we were something, that our significance, because we walked with God every day. The God who created all of it, the God who created the universe, the stars, that's the one that was walking with us. The God who made the axis of the earth tilt just right. The God who made the gravitational pulls of all the objects just right. That God, who can do that, who can make something come from nothing. That God was walking with us. And we knew who we were because we were special because he said we were. And so all of us are trying to get back to that place. We're trying to do something that we're recreating it, saying, if I could just know who I am like that. And so all of us put this something in our life, something that we've got to do, something that we can accomplish. And if I get to this thing, I will feel like I'm not a loser anymore. I'll feel like I'm not a bum. Like Rocky said, if he could just fight Apollo Creed, he said, I'll just feel like I'm not a bum if I can step in the ring with that guy. All of us are saying, if I could just do this thing, if I could just do something like that, if I could accomplish this, make this much money, get this kind of girl, have this kind of life, I wouldn't be a bum anymore. I would mean something. My life would mean something. But you know what? When we put our hope into something like that, if it gets taken away from us, if it gets stripped from us, or we lose it, or we fail, it devastates us. Because we put all of our hope into it. It devastates us. We can't recover from it. If we lost it, because we don't know who we are. We're trying to find out who we are. We're trying to find out our identities. We don't know what we're worth. and we don't know that we're lovable. So we keep looking for other things to try to find it. And that's what Lot is doing here. And he's finding it in his wealth. He's saying, my identity is in my wealth. If I can just get this land, my wealth is going to grow, my identity is going to be even further solidified, and I'm going to be confident of who I am. So his choices go like this. He says, me first, God and my uncle second. He puts himself first because he's presented with choices. He's got God here. He's got his own stuff to worry about, and he's got his uncle. And he says, forget that stuff. I'll put me first, and I'll put the rest of them second. His choice is just too selfish. So that's the problem of the choice. It's too shallow, and it's too selfish. Consistently, too shallow, too selfish. But you know what? If we really consider our choices, it should also paralyze us. Abram should have felt this. He should have felt paralyzed because he had been given a promise from God. God had told him, I'm going to do something great with you. Well, instead of just throwing this decision over to his nephew, shouldn't he have said, God, what do you want me to do? Shouldn't he have prayed about it? He's got a whole generation, a whole army, a whole nation coming after him. Shouldn't he have consulted God and said, God, what do you want me to do? I know you've got big plans here. But he doesn't. But he should have. He should have been praying about it. He should have been thinking about it. And Lot should have too. Lot should have looked at his life and said, I shouldn't be so shallow. I need to be less selfish. I've got to choose right because a lot is riding on this. You know, it's going to be beyond me. It's not just going to affect me. It's going to affect my wife. It's going to affect my kids. It's going to affect my entire wealth. All of these things are going to be affected here. So he's got to consider this too because his decisions really do matter. Your decisions really do matter in life. And it can even be a dreadful thing for you to have the choice for in front of you. Dreadful. Think about this. In this last week, have you ever made a decision that was wrong? In the last month, have you been wrong maybe a couple of times? Or in the past year, have you ever made some big mistakes that you wish you could get back? I think all of us would agree, yes, I have. But you know what we can't do? None of us in this room can look and say, I know when I'm going to be wrong again. I know the next time that I'm going to choose wrong. It's not like you just need a batting average and, oh, I was wrong the last four times, so the next one's going to be wrong. I'll just make sure it's not an important decision. You don't get to do that with it. You don't know when the next bad decision is going to come, and you don't know how big the consequences are going to be. You just don't know. And because of that, it should make us fearful because we know that we're not just affecting our own life, but we're affecting the life of others. You're doing this in school. You're doing this with your career. You're doing this with who you're dating or who you're going to marry. All of these decisions, they carry a lot of weight behind them. And it should be scary. It is scary because it's going to paralyze us because what is easy for us is not always what is best for us. The easiest decision for you is not going to be the most pleasing decision for your soul either. It's going to affect you differently. It's not just the easy one. And how do we look at this? Whenever we're approaching decisions, whenever we've got something that we've got to decide, what do we do? We always say, is it worth my time? Is it worth my time? Do I really commit to that? Well, maybe, I'm not sure yet. I'll see if something better comes along. And we're masters at this. We are so beautiful at this. It's amazing. Somebody comes up to you and they ask you to do something and you're like, I'll get back to you on that. And I'm just like, that was so silky smooth. You didn't tell me no, you didn't tell me yes, you didn't make me feel bad, you said, I'll get back to you. I was like, you are incredible at this. Gosh, I wish I could be that good. But you know what happens with that? Whenever we're, apply that in a different situation. I asked my wife out last Friday, I took her out on a date. What if she said, oh, I'll get back to you? What? Thank the Lord you didn't do that. Thank you, babe. I love you. But she didn't do that to me because she wasn't looking for something better. You know, thank God she wasn't. I'm in a lot of trouble. A whole bunch of trouble. But we always want to know if it's worth our time. But you know what? Really, we're not fooling anybody. Because all of us can tell when something's hollow and when it's shallow. If I'm up here, like I am, and you're down there, like you are, we have established this. Some philosopher would actually debate this quite a long time. If I'm up here just railing you, all of your dirty laundry, I'm throwing it out. Throwing it out, and everyone's laughing at your expense. Everyone's rolling in, but you're not. And it's all about you, all of us, everything you've ever done. Embarrassing situation. If when we leave, I tap you on the back and I'm like, thanks for being a good sport. And I walk on. You know the shadow. You know it's not sincere. We can detect it when it's insincere. But if I say something and I know it was hurtful, I expose something about you, or I did something, if immediately my voice starts to quiver, my bottom lip trembles, and tears are welling up in my eyes. Now, I mean, some of you guys are just hard to please. But at least you know I'm serious. You know, you would think that he was sincerely sorry. We can see it. We know when someone's really genuinely sincerely sorry. We can see through the hollowness. But yet all of us, you know, we're so willing to accept partial truths. We're so willing to accept lip service from ourselves and from others, from everybody. We are willing to accept these things because we know deep down we are no better. That we don't do a better job of being more truthful, that we are the same. There's a story by Charles Dickens called Great Expectations. Any of y'all required to read that book? Few of y'all required. Anybody see the movie? There's been a couple movies out about it. So a few of you. There are two characters, two of the main characters. One is a lady, and she sits in her house all day long, and she wears a wedding dress. That's all she wears every day. Her house is torn apart. She lives in this kind of big mansion thing, but it's overgrown. There's vines everywhere. It's, you know, she is a disheveled woman by far. And she is raising a young girl, and the girl's name is Stella. And she raises her just the way that she would ideally have her life, because the older woman, she was stood up at the altar when she was going to get married. So she vowed in her life, I will never, ever give my heart away again. I'll never let anyone so close to me where they can derail me like that again. She just said, I'm never going to do it. And you know what? I'm going to raise this little girl so she doesn't care about anything. She'll never give her heart away. She's going to be a man eater. She's going to get revenge on all those guys who did bad things to me. And so basically, that's how she trains this little girl, that every guy is going to fall in love with her, but then she'll never be able to give her heart away. And really, that's the extent of how paralyzed we can become. You're either going to build up a wall around you so that no one can get in, so you can never be hurt to shield yourself from the pain of this life, or you're just not going to care about anything. You're not going to care about other people. You won't even care about yourself to an extent. But all this time, we know that we can see beneath it. We know there's a hollowness of it. We tend to look at these people, you know, it's a jump, but that's where it takes us. In both cases, whether you're going to wall yourself off so you never get hurt, or you're just going to be apathetic, it's still a fear. It's a fear about being who you really are. And so we choose to put our personalities out there instead of who we really are. We put up a front about who we are instead of really revealing ourselves. But we are still these people living by our senses. We're making these choices all the time. We're making choices. But we can't tell ourselves when we're going to be wrong next. We don't know if it's going to be a good choice or a bad choice. We're left with decisions, and the weight of it really should destroy us. It should make us collapse under the weight of these choices. But we still have to make a choice. One of my friends was asking me this question, are you happy? And I mean, that's what we're all really here. We're trying to be happy. We're trying to find happy. That Garden of Eden, we're trying to find it again. And you know what? When we consider it, and one of the things that we look forward to, many of us will look forward to, is the day that we get married. He was asking me, what was it like when you got married? Was it just the best day of your life? Was it so much fun? And I was like, you know what? When I got married to my wife, it was a great day. But it wasn't as good as you're thinking. He's like, why? I mean, you married your wife. You've been married for 5 years now. And it's just not as good as what you think. He's like, what do you mean? I was like, when you lose your cool with your wife, when you reveal all your ugliness, your nastiness, to the fuller extent than you've ever done before, and you're worried sick, once you come to your senses out of your rage or whatever, that she's going to leave you. Because she has every right to leave you. It would be justified. And you treat her so horribly that she should feel like she can leave, and you know you're helpless. But when she looks at you then and says, I want to be here with you. It's when you have fully revealed yourself in all your flaws, and she says, I still want to be with you. That happiness far outweighs the happiness of the day you got married. It's so much better when she says, I want to be with you even when you're at your worst. That is so much better than the day I got married. It's so much greater when you fully give yourself and you don't hold anything back. You take the walls down, you take the apathy down, and you say, this is exactly who I am. And she says, I still want you. That happiness far outweighs the day I got married. And this brings us to our last choice. It's the faithful choice. Abraham, he comes back to the place, the original place of faith. He comes back. He comes back to the altar. It's a symbolic thing. He's been in Egypt. He threw his wife under the bus, and he's coming back. He tried it his own way. He's saying, I tried to use my own intellect. I tried to figure this whole thing out of how to navigate through life. He says, I couldn't do it. He comes back. He remembers the altar. He remembers his faith, and he says, I'm worshiping God. I'm remembering again what it's like to trust in him. I'm not trusting in myself anymore. I'm going to trust in him. That it's all wrapped up in this scripture, in this verse, where he remembers the altar, and he calls upon the name of the Lord. It means he worships the Lord again. But right after that, right after he worships the Lord again, you know what he does? He says, hey, Lot, I know we're having these troubles. You just decide to do whatever you want, and I'll go the other way. Why would he? It's crazy. This decision is going to materially affect his life. His family, his wealth, the promise of God, everything is affected by this decision. And he almost cavalierly throws it out there and says, oh, you can choose whatever you want. It's cool. We'll go the other way. Why are we coming back to faith? Do that for this man. If he's coming back to faith, why would he then say he can trust Lot to make a decision for him on his behalf? We tend to see it one way or the other. It's hard for us. We tend to see it like this. You either make good choices or you make bad ones. We look at Adam and Eve. We look at Lot and we say, you just made bad choices. You need to make better choices. If you made better choices, you wouldn't be in this situation. That's the way we tend to look at it. And we think, okay, the pressure comes on us that we have to make better choices too, or we're going to end up in some bad place. But you know what? There is a mystery that happens in faith. We think it's either all of us. We've got to work really hard. We've got to get there. We think. But if we really go down that road, we end up paralyzed. We end up making walls around ourselves. We end up thinking that we're better than other people if we're succeeding. We tend to look down on others. If you're doing well, if you're not doing well, you feel like you've got no confidence and you feel like you're the scum of the earth. It's a real slippery slope in our heart. But you know what? When he comes back to faith, there's a different option here. What if God has put our life out there and he's doing something that we can't see and he's in control of our life? Maybe it's all that way. Well, that way, to the extreme, can take us to apathy. We can just say, oh, I just don't need to do anything. God's in control. He's doing everything. It's the whole free will versus predestination. But you know what? It's a lot more like this. You walk up to the door that God is inviting you to. And on the door, there's an inscription. It says, knock, and the door will be open to you. But it's a little, we'll bring it up to our day. It actually has a doorbell. And you push the doorbell, and it says, instead of going ping-dong, it's like, all who choose will be saved. And so you're walking into this door, and it looks like I've got to make a good choice here. God is inviting me to all who. Yeah. He's inviting me into his place so that I could be one with him. But you know what? You go in and you experience the presence of God, and you're like, this is great, I'm so happy, I made a good choice. And you go to shut the door because you don't want any air conditioning to flow out of the thing. And you shut that door, and you know what it says this time? You look back on it, and it says, you did not choose me, but I chose you. How can that be? On the front side, it said, knock and you will be saved. And on the back side, it says, you didn't choose me, but I chose you. It's just like a coin with two sides. Something's happening here. Like in Proverbs, it says this. It says, the mind of man plans his ways, but the Lord directs his steps. You mean to tell me if I'm here and you're thinking of my ways, then God's going to direct all my little steps? How does that make? I don't know. But yet, that's the way the scriptures present it. We want to make it free will or predestination, and the scriptures will not let you do that. It's something different. God is not just letting you make your own decisions over here and doing all this. He's working in your life not because of your decisions. He's not limited by your decisions. He's working in your life despite your decisions. Despite your errors, despite your failures, he's working. He can still do it. And so when you come to God knowing this, trusting in God can actually free you. You're not bound up by just your limitations and your choices. It can free you. Because he can give you his goodness. He can give you his presence despite your choices. It's a freeing thing. It's a wonderful thing. And you say, thank you. All the pressure, the pressure valve is released. And you're just spewing out all this pressure you've been holding in for so long. And you just say, it's all off of me. All the pressure is off because it's about him. It's about what he did. The pressure is off. And you say, why? Well, let's keep reading. Genesis 13. The Lord said to Abram, after Lot had parted from him, look around wherever you are, from the north and the south, the east and the west. All the land that you see, I will give to you and your offspring forever. Lift up your eyes, look from the place where you are. He's taking him up to a high mountain. He's saying, all the land that you see, I'm going to give it to you. But how can God give this to this man? This man he's done horrible things and he's going to continue to do horrible things again. Has God just lost his mind? Is God going crazy? Did he lower the standard and say, oh, I have too high of a standard, I'm just going to lower it so that he can get this blessing? How can God do this? How can he give him the blessing and say, all of this I'm going to give you to such an unworthy man? He could, because this story, it points to another man. There was another man who was taken up to a mountain. And he was offered the world. Someone offered him everything. But you know what? He refused. He refused. When Satan took Jesus up to the mountain, he offered everything to Jesus, but there is a wonderful irony here. The irony is that when Satan offered Jesus the world, if you would just bow down and serve me, he was offering Jesus what was already his. But he was offering it without suffering, without going to the cross, without dying the death God had it for us. He offered it to him without doing that. He just said, you can have it. But Jesus refused. He said, no, I won't do that. He came to lose everything for us. When God takes Abraham up to this mountain, and he said, I'm going to give this to you, he gives it to him, but he doesn't deserve it. It's not his right to have this land, to have this promise. It's not his right. But when Satan takes Jesus up, it is Jesus' right that he says, I don't want to do that. I don't want to take it. And why does he do that? Why is God able to give us this wonderful blessing that we don't deserve, that we haven't earned, and despite our failures? It's because Jesus refused the blessing that should have been his. The blessing that was his. He said, I won't take it so I can give it to you. The blessing that was due to him, he said, I'm not going to take it so that they can have it. That's what he was doing. Only because Jesus lost it all could he give it to us. When we look at Abraham's life, it points to one that is so much farther, so much greater than him. But we couldn't really be like Abraham. We could never try hard enough to be Abraham. But unless we looked up with our eyes and we saw the one he is pointing to, if we saw Jesus, the one he was really pointing us to, that Jesus gave it all so that we could have life. So that we could have the wealth of Christ, because he gave it all up so that for us. And when we look at our life, we look at these besetting sins, we look at our failures, we feel maybe a little depressed. We think that people around us aren't behaving right. We think that people aren't treating us right with enough respect the way that we deserve. We're wondering what our value is. We're wondering if our life is significant. The only way to deal with these issues in your life is whenever we change our identity from ourselves. And the foundation of our life, it no longer being ourselves, but the foundation of our life is the grace of God and what has been done through Christ. When that identity changes, only then are we going to be able to operate and behave like Abraham did? Where all the weight is going to take off of you, all of it's going to remove. Because we all are trying to make this garden of the Lord work, but most of us do it without God. We're trying to recreate it. But Jesus gave up the ultimate so that he could bring us back to the garden. He gave it all up so that he could restore it to